Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, David Bahnsen on work as the meaning of life.
We can't create out of nothing. We can only create from what God has given. But this is what the Genesis account explains. Our intent, our purpose is here on earth. That's why I refer to work as the meaning of our lives.
David Bahnsen next. Coming up, Spencer Dahlke talks with businessman David Bahnsen about his engaging book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life. He believes it's in work, that is, effort, service, and striving of every kind, that we discover our meaning and purpose. A discussion about work today on this Labor Day.
Well, the first question I kind of wanted to ask is, obviously, you're writing about work, and you talk about this unspoken attitude that Americans have that the purpose of work is to not have to do it anymore. If you could tell us a little bit about what that means and how we got here.
Well, one of the things I try to do in the book is make the historical case that a lot of it is a byproduct of two really big blessings, two really good things. And what I refer to is the increase in life expectancy. That's a good problem to have. A lot of people never thought about this idea of retirement because their retirement plan was to die. And yet, the baby boomer generation entered the workforce. From the time they were born to the time that they entered the workforce, the life expectancy had gone up about almost 10 years. And then by the time they had entered the workforce or ready to exit the workforce, it had gone up almost another 10 years. It's about 17 or 18 put together, not quite 20. But what that meant is that people were going to have the mortality, the life expectancy, to theoretically have a period of time that they could do this thing called retirement. But then the other big blessing after World War II was just a tremendous growth in our economy that created an awful lot of wealth and prosperity. Our economy grew net of inflation by 3.1% per year for about 60 years. From the World War II to the financial crisis. So now IRAs and pensions and 401ks, people were living longer and had the general means to do this thing called retirement. And as that became more of a potential reality in American culture, it began being marketed heavily to people like, hey, you can stop working at 60, you can start getting a pension at 65 and have this long period of time that effectively you'll end your life on a 20-year vacation. And this imagery of sailboats and golf courses and all these things being what everyone's going to do for the last 20 years of their life. You know, we don't have time for me to get into all of what I believe about that as it means to our senior population. There's a lot of nuance and everything around it. But what I do think it did, to answer your question, is it created a narrative that people viewed work now as something they'd go in to do so that they could then accumulate enough to not have to do it anymore and check out. And lo and behold, plenty of people with their success in work or with their timeline, they may not need till 65. They may be in a position where they're say, hey, I'm ready to check out in my 40s. And my view of it is whether one is 75, 55, 35, nothing changes their God-created purpose, which is to be useful, to be active. And while I think there's a lot of people, and I'll be one of them, that will keep coming into the office till the day they carry me out horizontally, there are others that they probably can't work the same job when they're 75 that they worked when they're 35, a construction worker and very, you know, there's a lot of different nuances here. What I don't think requires nuance is my high-level statement that people need to be active and productive no matter what age they are. It means different things for different ages and stages, but that mentality needs to be that God made us to work, and there's a lack of expertise and experience in our workforce now because of so many seniors being out of the workforce.
You told us a little bit about where this idea of retirement comes from. I guess we're both products of this culture of retirement is kind of this thing now that we can look forward to. But the point that you make with the book is that work is the meaning of life. Yeah. You make that statement. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means and when that idea kind of planted in your head?
Let me say what it means by starting with what it doesn't mean, because I think that there are some that can say, wait, is David saying that the meaning of our life is our next promotion or our next paycheck or our next, you know, sort of socioeconomic strata? And I think all those things are important, by the way, and I don't speak against them. And I want people to be more successful and more achievement and more productivity that involves more influence and all those things in their whatever their chosen professional domain may be. But no, that isn't what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the meaning of life as work is the fact that God made us to be an image bearer of Him, and He defined what that meant in the creation account. That He made us to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. And that the avodah of how we worship God, the Hebrew word used to describe this work in Genesis 2, is the same word for worship as it is for our work, our actual earthly labors. The same word used in the fourth commandment, 6 days shalt thou work. In Ephesians 2, when it talks about we are created to do good work, it does not mean good work of charity and good work of compassion. Those things are very important, but the word used was actual vocational work. And we see this modeled by our Heavenly Father. He was a worker. He worked in creating the world. And what He did is ask us, who He cares about, who He loves, who He made in special communion with Him, who He made to be with Him. And in fact, when sin separated us from Him, He cared so much as to send a Savior to reunite us to Him who would redeem the broken world to Him. And that in that intent, it was for us to go create things out of the raw material of the creation that He made out of nothing. We can't create out of nothing. We can only create from what God has given. But this is what the Genesis account explains. Our intent, our purpose is here on earth. And that's why I refer to work as the meaning of our lives.
My understanding, if I'm correct, is that Marxism also kind of says that the most important thing about a human being is what he produces. I know you're not a Marxist, but would you compare and contrast your argument with a Marxist understanding of work?
Well, it's the polar opposite understanding. I'm not just simply saying something that isn't Marxist. I'm saying something that's the opposite of Marx. Marx believed that what you're describing was dehumanizing. I believe it is rehumanizing. That it is humanizing because I have an anthropology, a view of the human person that says mankind was made with dignity. Where Marx believed that mankind became a slave to nature in having to work and that this was the most unfortunate thing that we had to work to separate from. And then he believed, ultimately, that was all predicate to his ultimate worldview, that workers, the proletariats, were victims of a class struggle from the entrepreneurs, and that we had to break down that inequality. I believe that entrepreneurialism is a blessing. I believe people creating something, producing goods and services that meet the needs of humanity is exactly the vision of society we ought to have. That by it, human beings can be most fulfilled when they use their God-given talents and giftedness to meet the needs of others. But Marx had no such view of the human person, whereby the worker, him or herself, was important, and the people being served by that work, benefiting from the goods and services they produced, were being served. If you have that theology that the worker matters to God and the person being served by the work matters to God, then you end up with a theology that values the work between those two points. Marx obviously failed on all of those points.
How do you think an incorrect view of work has made its way into the church? Do you think it has? And how has it affected our theology and how we worship, et cetera?
Well, in a lot of ways, I think that the church actually led the way with a bad view of work here, where generally I feel like the world goes astray with something and the church catches up to it a little later. That's very unfortunate. But in this case, in the early 20th century, I think the church largely retreated from the public square. And this was most evidenced in politics, in education, and in the marketplace, in the workplace. In the later portion of the 20th century, a lot of Christians said, no, 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 this is not working. We want to come back into politics. A lot said we want to come back into education. They were unhappy with the results of secular indoctrination of their kids. But for Christians to come back into the marketplace, they weren't exactly sure what that looked like. A lot of evangelicals had been successful in the workforce. A lot of Catholics had been successful in the workforce. But a faith and work movement took off about 25, 30 years ago that wasn't so much addressing why the work itself mattered. It was seeking to equip Christians to be able to pray at the workforce, to have Christian testimony, to do their work with ethics and integrity, to have fellowship. There would be, you know, Thursday morning Bible studies and prayer groups and networking and breakfast stuff, coffee event, you know, all that, all important, all good. But none of it necessarily addressing the fundamental issue of how much technology mattered, agriculture mattered, entrepreneurialism mattered, finance, this notion of real serious Christian expertise in Silicon Valley, in Wall Street, in the Midwest, in oil and gas fields, whatever the case may be. So I think the church was content in the 20th century to leave those things and is now having to play a lot of catch up in terms of what it means for Christians to re-engage in commercial society.
I guess carrying that idea a little further, if you think that if the church kind of led the way with withdrawing from business culture, you know, a lot of people complain about employers and like mistreatment in the workplace. And I don't know, do you think some of this is a result of the church withdrawing and not promoting a healthy view of work?
Well, let's put it this way. It hasn't helped. If Christians are going to lead the way with treating people the right way, and Christians are not in a position of leadership, there are not enough Christian bosses, there are not enough Christian influence on bosses, there are not enough Christians in the boardroom, for us to be in a position to influence the culture that way, we have to be influencers. And so I definitely think that our testimony there has been negated to a large degree. But it's more than just being a good model for treating people the right way. That's obviously incredibly important. I'm not one who's convinced we have a hugely systemic issue of, it's not like the Dickens model, you know, 19th century abuse of workers and factories type of stuff. I'm sure there are bad things that happen out there. But systemically, I think if anything, there's almost too much coddling of a lot of workers today. But what I would agree is not happening is enough Christian leadership that we're a vanguard on this, that we're leading the way. And I think that what we have to restore is this belief that mediocrity is a sin and that proficiency and excellence are commandments. And if Christians can demonstrate proficiency and excellence then and repudiate mediocrity, then we'll be in a position to have an influence over those things that we say we want to influence.
You make a couple points in your introduction. I wanted to ask about one, that work has dignity. So if it has inherent dignity, then you know you don't have to work at like a huge financial institution like yourself to have valuable work. You could be like a trash driver. But you also make the point too between like you draw a line between Steve Jobs and the teen who is, you know, in his parents' basement playing video games, that, you know, Steve Jobs is obviously contributing more to society. I guess considering those two ideas, how do you think we can measure the value of our work as Christians?
Well, I think that the measure is not in the size of paycheck, but in the heart and output of the person doing the work. And that the Bible is very clear, you know, to those who much is given, much is required. Different people have different skills, different interests. Some jobs are a stepping stone to a different job. And yet I believe we're going to be held accountable for the level of work we do at each station in life that we're in. And so if someone wants to be a big corner office lawyer one day, but in college they're waiting tables, I think they need to wait tables at a restaurant to the glory of God. They need to care for those customers. They need to help their boss earn more profit. They need to really be a great witness of what it means to do the work excellently. But that's not the end of that person's career. They might be moving on to something different. Others may be working on an assembly line for their whole career, and they need to do that work to the glory of God with joy, with ideation, with celebration, and I believe that that attitude is infectious. It's part of the Christian life, and I believe that it ultimately builds this sort of dominion for Christians' success in the marketplace. This is the vision we all need to adopt.
Well, my guest today is David Bahnsen. He's an economist and the founder, managing partner, and chief investment officer of the Bahnsen Group. We're talking about his book, Full Time, about work as the meaning of life and what it means for the Christian and our callings. I'm considering two categories of people, young adults and people that are maybe approaching, you know, the later years of their life, starting to consider for young adults what they want to do with their life, and for what we might call retirees, for lack of a better term, what to do with the rest of their lives. I guess for young adults, what advice would you offer for them as they try to discover what their calling would be?
Things that I have become very fond of saying for young people is that they have to reprogram this idea that your biggest question when you're starting off in life is what your passions are. Go chase your dreams. I think that people need to start with what their skills are, what they're good at, what their talents are. And I think it's very interesting how people have a way of all of a sudden what they're really good at becoming what they're very passionate about. People have a funny way of liking it when they get complimented, when they get praised, when they get promotions, when they grow in a company. You know, the notion that everyone is supposed to go be a pro golfer or a, you know, all these kind of dreamlike jobs. It's fine for us to really desire to work in a forum that we're going to love and that we care about the thing we're doing. But it's important not to overly romanticize the very beginning part of our career. If one gets into something that they're good at and works very hard at it, it is either going to be something that they truly end up loving, or it's going to open doors to things that are adjacent that they love more. Either way, I think that's the bedrock of what you want to start with, to think very hard about what your giftedness is and build off of that.
I don't know if you've ever read John Eldridge, but I think he had a book, Wild at Heart, about the heart of, well, you know, heart of a man, but I'm sure there's the point can be applied to women too, where he says start with your heart and, you know, take a step of faith. If you really want to do something, go and learn how to be good at it, which sounds, you know, contrary to what you suggested you believe about that. How do we know what we're good at when we you know, haven't spent years doing whatever it is?
Well, I don't think that everyone does know exactly what they're good at. I don't think that at 21 or 23 that someone needs to know exactly what their whole portfolio of skill sets is going to be. I think that people have a general idea on certain broad categories. You know, one of the hard parts, I've written a book that is what we call about macro, top-down principles that are generally trying to provide theological beliefs and high-level understanding of certain things that I think are really important. But then the prudential wisdom required to make a micro decision is different than the macro. So what Johnny is supposed to do or Debbie is supposed to do with her situation or his situation is very, very different. You know, there's a sense in which Eldridge could have been meaning something that I'd be totally in agreement with, and there's a sense in which he could mean something that I vehemently disagree with. I think it's important. I remember reading the book, and I understand the notion of people taking leaps of faith. But if we were to say that what that means is that every 23-year-old girl who has someone on TikTok she really looks up to ought to just go try to be a life as an influencer. That wouldn't be a leap of faith. It'd be a leap of stupidity. And I'm a 51-year-old guy who blew my knee out 30 years ago and works in an office all day and have become pretty good at managing money over the years. And if I said, you know what, I'm taking a leap of faith. My dream is to be a pro NBA player. You know, I don't think Eldridge or you or me or anybody would take that seriously, nor should they. So we all know that there's kind of a limiting principle around it. But this is what the Bible talks about with wisdom. So how does somebody know? Well, they don't ask me if I don't know them. They ask the people in their life. Get advice from a multitude of counselors. You know, I've gone through school. You've seen the papers I've written. You've seen the reports I've done. I've interned at this company. I tried this thing. I've gotten a general idea of where I seem to fit. Someone who's really terrible with people probably doesn't want to pursue a career in sales. Someone who's hyper-organized might really like a career in engineering. I mean, there's limiting things to get to a point of prudential wisdom. I don't think it's that hard. What I think is that this overly romanticized notion that every 25-year-old should already have their dream job, and that if they don't, that their life is a disappointment. I think that's an awful way to view the world. And I have no doubt in my mind Eldridge would agree.
I guess turning to the other side of the spectrum, from the young adults to our elders, the retirees, the whatever you might call them, I'm considering most of our listeners, because we broadcast in Montana and Wyoming and Nevada and, you know, Eastern California, there's a good chance they're probably a farmer. So it's a lot of active work. You're getting older. You might not be able to keep up with some of this active work and just keep coming to the office. What advice would you offer them as they consider, well, what do we do with what remains of our lives?
Yeah, and that's, again, the exact principle I was just alluding to, that I believe that there are certain things, oftentimes office jobs allow people to do later, and oftentimes some of the rural jobs in agriculture do not. But they do still require expertise, mentorship, oversight. They may very well be off the farm altogether and yet in a position to be very productive in various other volunteer efforts or whatnot. There is no playbook that says exactly what each lawyer should do or each farmer should do in the senior years of their life. What there is a general principle that says the senior years of your life are not there to be totally checked out of useful productive activity. And so what the useful productive activity might be, I have a really clear vision of what that could be in my career. And I've spent enough time talking to people in different occupations to know that there's almost limitless opportunities in every career. But I certainly accept that the age and stage of that's going to be different in other sectors. And you know who I think knows more than anyone how a 70-year-old can be effective in a farming position when they're not in the same position to do the physical work they did when they were 30 is that 70-year-old. I think that they could answer that question.
It sounds like you saying, you know, good work is productive work that produces something of value. What would that look like for...
Well, I'm not merely saying it's good work. I'm saying it isn't work if it doesn't do that. That's what the definition of work is. Work that is producing goods and services that meet the needs of others. So an entrepreneur might fail with something, but that's in itself a good thing. You learn from failure. You know, why did it fail? Because it didn't meet the needs of others, or it was too expensive, or it was unprofitable, or the market liked it at first, but then found another product they liked better. The point of work is not to sit and dig a hole and fill it and dig a hole and fill it for no purpose at all. It's extended to meeting the needs of human beings.
That helps give some clarity, I guess, to our older listeners as they're considering, you know, continuing with their work. What do you think that looks like for them as they maybe have to start stepping away from farming or labor or whatever it might be? How can they continue to like bring value to their community?
By mentoring 30-year-olds that are doing it, by advising, coaching, consulting 20-year-olds, by having knowledge and expertise that they convey to others about what the process looks like. It's a limitless opportunity.
Well, you also wrote a chapter on the Genesis creation account and its call on our lives. I know you mentioned this a little bit at the beginning of the interview. I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit more about how the gospel can like influence our work and vice versa.
I will certainly say that I believe that the gospel mirrors the Genesis account. I don't think the Bible ever contradicts itself. I think that the gospel is the story of good news, and people have every right to wonder what is the good news. And the good news is Redeemer has come to redeem us to God because of separation. The separation was caused by sin. Mm-hmm. The question is, what does that redemption look like? What are we being restored to? The heavenly vision is that we're being restored in new heavens and new earth to what God intended in his creation of the world before sin. And in his creation of the world before sin, man and woman worked. Man and woman worked without sin. They worked in communion with one another, and they worked in communion with God. And that is what I believe our vision of work ought to be, is to glorify God by doing those very things that we were tasked to do in the garden, to worship God in our work and to build civilization. Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth was not merely a commandment to have kids. Filling the earth meant filling it with technology, tools, agriculture, roads, various advancements to our quality of life. It's one of the most beautiful ideas in all of Scripture. I think it's at the core of the gospel message.
How can we celebrate our work well this Labor Day?
Well, I think that Labor Day has a lot of other meanings historically, but we can just do what I recommend Christians do about Easter Sunday. Every day is Labor Day. Celebrate work every day. Celebrate workers every day. Celebrate those who employ workers every day. Enjoy a Monday holiday as summer ends and fall kicks off, but do so with a deep understanding of how much God cares about our work and how meaningful it is to Him and His kingdom.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, businessman David Bonson, author of Full Time, Work, and the Meaning of Life. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Hannah Brencher on cultivating a life of presence in a digitally connected world.
But when we think about the first half of that scripture, you know, the enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy. I think a lot of times we focus in on the killing and the destroying, and we forget about the stealing. And that's what I started to ask is, well, what is he stealing? He's stealing time, and he's stealing devotion, and he's stealing our vibrancy. If we're just looking right at the phone, those are the things that are being stolen as our attention is being stolen. And so there's been a natural correlation that I wasn't expecting between putting away the thing that the enemy wants to use in order to step into that abundant life that was there the whole time. It wasn't like I didn't have it. It was right there. I just had to learn to be present to it.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.